Well, I just wanted to comment that, you know, in many of the rotating experiments, we've seen that the turbulent states appear to be interacting collections of waves, and also thinking back to Paul and others' works on the core and how the processes may be dominated by Mach waves, that a suggestion that comes to mind is that in developing numerical models for the core or for stars, one can, before sending the numerics into a far from equilibrium state by driving, by convection, or whatever mechanism you have, that you could simply probe the equilibrium state of your model and just see which wave modes it supports and the cues of those various waves, and if in fact then you could find out which of those waves are overdamped and which are underdamped, and at least know the dynamical regime in an equilibrium sense that you are with respect to various wave modes that could be present.
Along the same line, it depends on the code, but if I understand well, using some method, you actually want to filter out some of these waves. So we know that for sound waves, that was mentioned by Tomre. I think that in most of the geodynamo calculations, the inertial waves are also filtered out by taking an implicit method for the Coriolis force. So I don't know. I'm not a specialist of numerical models. I don't know. I like Dan's suggestions, but is it something that people have the codes to actually look at, or?
Well, I think most methods don't use an implicit method, so inertial waves are not necessarily damped out. And in fact, in some cases, in special cases, you can observe these things. However, in the parameter regime, we usually run these models. I think most of these modes are heavily damped, which is not a nice thing because they are not necessarily as strongly damped in the risk core.
Well, again, I guess for the inertial modes in particular, I made the suggestion, a concrete suggestion, that in fact it's Ekman 10 to the minus 6 that's probably right about where Q equals 1 for the various lowest modes. And so to get into a very wavy state with the number of modes being underdamped, things on the order of 10 to the minus 7, you have to get somewhat away from the boundary where the first mode becomes of a Q equal 1 in order to get into such a regime. Although I realize that's difficult, as I understand it, maybe necessary nonetheless.
Well, yeah, I would agree. I guess 10 to the minus 6 is just on the verge. 10 to the minus 7 is hard, but maybe few years down the line.
I really just have a question, which is, if we have these wave turbulence, which tends to occur in systems with strong constraints, like strong magnetic field, strong rotation, or strong stratification, how can we differentiate these from kind of normal turbulence? I mean, presumably we're talking about linear waves here. I mean, you can always think of normal turbulence as wave turbulence, but it's gone very non-linear. So where does one fade out and the other one fade in?
Well, I mean, what I was interested in originally was that the Mach waves, gravitational energy goes into the waves, and the waves distribute them, they make the alpha effect, if you like. But, of course, it has to be a non-linear interaction of waves. It can't be a linear theory. That's the way I was looking at it, yes.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment about whether to the degree to which wave motion is present in numerical dynamos. I think it's perhaps not widely appreciated that a very common mode of convection in numerical dynamos consists of propagating Rossby waves, and we saw some examples of that, actually. So that's a low-frequency, convectively-driven wave type of motion, which is very prominent. And then the second point is that often the convection takes the form of columnar motion, and those columns in the numerical dynamos are built through a combination of viscous and Maxwell stresses, but also inertial waves propagating in the correct direction to support the column structure. So it's not clear that those waves are driving the dynamo per se, but there's no question that they're present.
with respect to the columnar motions, when you're in the situation where the inertial waves are all over damped, in fact, you get toward the Taylor Pradman limit. And so if you're seeing flows that are substantially or entirely Z independent, that is a sign that perhaps all of your inertial modes have been damped. That's the
a question that sort of relates to this and to what came up at lunch. So the turbulence in the astrophysical dynamos, believe that there's a small-scale dynamo produced along with a large-scale dynamo, and the coupling between the two is tricky. In the geodynamo, I'm wondering, both in the simulations and perhaps in the Earth itself, what is the expected or what is the amount of small-scale magnetic energy versus the large-scale magnetic energy, and how is that being seen in the simulations? I've heard that there isn't much small-scale field typically produced in the simulations. Is that expected is that correct with respect to what the Earth is actually exhibiting, or comment on that?
Concerning the Earth, certainly there's a certain amount of small-scale magnetic energy, and it's hard to quantify because from observations we know the spectrum only up to spherical harmonic degree 12 or 14. At some point, obviously, the spectrum must drop rather rapidly, and this point cannot be too far away. It may be at spherical harmonics around 100, but the magnetic Reynolds number in the Earth's core is not that astronomically large, and so therefore, probably at around 100 or 150, there must be a strong drop. And of course, in the most of the geodynamo simulations, this drop in spectrum occurs rather earlier. But I think, in generally, it's true there is probably the ratio of large-scale magnetic energy to small-scale magnetic energy is certainly higher in the Earth's core than in say stellar dynamos.
I think we'd better move properly on to topic two now, which was put to me that we ought to have a discussion on the role of turbulence in experiments. Is it always bad news? This was probably involved some of the same people again, but
the talks.
Yes.
In fact, I had this question after Gary Forrest's talk, where there were quite a substantial effort made to eliminate turbulence. But why? Why not studying turbulent diffusivity? Why not, if you say that it's so well pronounced, it's a fantastic object to study. How it reacts to imposed magnetic field, turbulent magnetic diffusivity, does it differ from turbulent kinematic diffusivity? There are so many questions, theoreticians will give their left and right hands to know the answer, and you have everything at your hands.
So the talk I gave didn't address this, but we've spent the last 4 years looking at those issues. Explicitly, so we've not constrained the flow. We've looked for mean field effects. That is, what is the turbulence doing to drive currents? And we've tried to document that. And I agree with you that this doesn't have to be studied in a dynamo. And it's an interesting point in its own right. We'd like to continue these studies, doing transient electrical skin depth measurements and things along these lines to measure directly what the turbulent diffusivities are and relate them in some sense to, you know, to theory. I agree with you. I would say it differently. The mean field currents are comparable to those induced by the mean flows. Okay, so that's, I mean, in terms of whether or not we have not been able to relate those currents to, say, alphas and betas and tensors and so forth, and yet we know that the currents which are being driven are comparable to the large scale, the currents driven by the large scale flow. No, he made an estimate of how big it might be based upon the fluctuation levels, okay? We have measurements of mean field-driven currents which are comparable to the other currents driven. So I'm cagey because I don't call it a beta effect. We don't know that it's a beta effect. What we know is that the currents which are being driven are comparable to those driven by induction, the mean induction.
But would the test tube method that we use in the Merkle simulation?
Possibly, but it requires a special implementation in the experiment. Yep. Right. How do we do this from externally imposed magnetic fields? We can use time-dependent magnetic fields. The theory hasn't been thought through for time-dependent cases, and it's very inhomogeneous system. We have we have boundary layers. We have turbulence which varies. It's strong around propellers and weak in other regions. So the inhomogeneities make it difficult to probe in some global sense.
Okay. Concerning the VKS experiment, we have been working since 10 years to study the influence of turbulence on the dynamo. And as you know, there are only three experiments around the world that managed to get the dynamo. Two of them are very close to the laminar kinematic dynamo. But for the VKS experiment, in fact, it happens that the dynamo itself is partly caused maybe by the turbulence. So that's why I was saying no, it's not bad news. No, we didn't try to measure any beta effect in the experiment. Maybe we were talking with Redler, and about that we can maybe measure something. I don't know if it is different from carry or not. We can try to measure that, but without turbulence, there would not be any dynamo in VKS.
But turbulence can also have a very trivial effect. Thinking of the Karlsruhe dynamo, which has rarely been mentioned here, we've put a lot of effort in thinking how many of these columns one builds in the experiment. And it turns out that there's a quite large number that was the optimum. And thinking of the S2T2 flows, which are in the VKS type flows, they're likely to be non-optimal in the sense that there are not enough rolls or not enough vortices. And the effect of the turbulence can simply be to add more of a smaller size, which make an SNTN, if you wish, which has simply a lower critical magnetic Reynolds number than the S2T2. No, it's not a matter of scale separation. It's simply a matter of, do you prefer to have a few big vortices or many small vortices? There's going to be an optimum somewhere. And thinking of the Karlsruhe example, the optimum is rather in the rather many small vortices rather than only having two big ones. And it could be that, well, you perhaps don't want to like it, perhaps don't want to call it turbulence, but at least if the big vortices decay in smaller ones, they may simply become more efficient for purely geometric reasons without being, yeah.
Three, shall we? Yeah. Well, yeah. Topic three. Yes. This is the question.
Which results?
The measurements. For example, for me, I'm an A student. It's partly, you know, it's mixing length theory.
So our plans are to measure local measurement locally the fluctuating velocity field and the local fluctuating magnetic field and see if that makes sense for the turbulent EMS we see. We'd like to apply transient fields measuring electrical skin depths and make an estimate of the turbulent conductivity, if you will. That's a PhD thesis that's taking place right now. So.
Initial magnetic configuration.
That's sort of what we're doing.
Suppose you take a uniform field initially, without turbulence, you know the decay time.
Right.
Now you put in turbulence, then the decay time becomes shorter.
I would say we're one step up in sophistication by using working in frequency space rather than working in decay measurements. But that's something to do. That's something to do. Yep. Yeah.
It was quite popular this morning. We were talking about a lot today about fundamental dynamo theory, and there was a question of creation of flux versus creation of field, and we thought this might be a suitable topic because it seemed to attract a lot of attention today. So perhaps we'd like to continue with that topic.
I would like to use the microphone to write on the board.
No, there is this really cool formula that not everybody's aware of that says that if you take B squared and divide it by the average of B squared, so this is the energy to the flux, this is what Berenger had, that he called it delta concept. But I mean, this is for B. And it's interesting that, amazingly enough, if you assume that this thing goes like Rm to the sum of power alpha, then alpha it can be expressed in terms of this funny quantities, which is the dimension of space minus the correlation dimension divided by 2 minus plus the cancellation exponent. And so these are all, you know, this is a theorem by Ed Ott. So if you take a random field, it has to satisfy this relation. And this tells you that if you want this quantity to be 1, of order 1, means you have to generate a lot of flux with a random field. It has to cancel, you know, then you want this thing to be 0. Otherwise, you know, this is huge, this will always be a huge number, you don't have any. In that, you have to have a random field that cancels nowhere in its base field. So, in your head, try to picture what an object like that must be like. All right?
Denominator, the average is taken over a certain length scale, and you vary this length scale.
I think we need to know a bit more about what D and D2 are.
D is 3,
okay, right. Yeah. Okay, so the point is that
this formula
is significantly less than 3, is that right, in any sensible fit, any sensible flow? Yeah. Well, Fausto like Galileo, I have to say, and yet it moves. We have the Earth and we have the Sun and they have coherent fields.
Can I just make the point with the formula that you wrote up that for any complete dynamo, the
average of B is going to be zero. So the crucial thing is what size of element are you going to average over? Because any div B is naught, and the average of B over if you include the whole object that you're talking about. Well, yeah, okay, but you know, I mean, how does this problem depend on how big the box you take is?
Well, you know, all of us want to do.
Yeah, well, maybe in practice, yeah, if I can add something. Maybe in practice for galaxies, it's not a trivial question because we know that the large scale field reverses many times over a radius. So if you just take half a galaxy, you will get zero and still you have some large scale flux.
Get that thing to be RM, to get the formula to make sense, is that the scale at which this field becomes smooth is RM to the minus a half. If, for instance, your velocity field is rough, then it will be some other power, and then your alpha will have a correction. So this is correct. I'm just saying. Right. But I mean, the only thing that is assumed is that you are dealing with a vector field that becomes smooth at a scale that scales like RM to the minus a half. That's it. That's the only thing that goes. It's the scale at which you can swap averages and integrals. That's it.
Yes, of course. I mean, D was the box dimension, and D2 is the correlation dimension. So that the two should then be equal. And that's most likely then the case to some.
Fausto, if you looked at the talk of François very carefully, you'll see that we measured this by chance. We didn't know it was something in VKS. Actually, we almost measured this, but it's going to zero at the threshold. Isn't there RM minus RM critical or something? You wrote RM to some threshold, to some exponent, or there is a RM minus RM critical? Okay. Okay. So if you are interested, we have it in VKS. You can come and look at it.
Speak on this general topic. Okay, that's fine. I think that's we're pretty close.
Well, I think that's a nice time now. I'd like to thank everybody and the people who managed to overcome their addiction to laptops. yeah, every 2 minutes' time we meet outside to look at the posters.